This is the Commercial Property Investing Explained series, brought to you by Steve Polisi. Find out how commercial property really works and start investing like the pros. Your education starts now. Welcome to the Commercial Property Explained series. I'm your host, Andrew Bean, and I'm here with the man, the myth, the legend, Steve Polisi. How are you, mate?
Hi, mate. How are you doing?
Just talking you up once again. How are you?
I'm good. I spent all weekend carving a wooden spoon with my dad, which was quite fun.
Wow. Do tell. Like a big wooden spoon? Is it like lifelike? Is it human size? Like
no, like a cooking wooden spoon. I bought it for my dad as a Christmas present as a bit of a joke. Like, oh, we're going to spend a whole day carving a wooden spoon from scratch. We were both like, this is going to be terrible. It was actually really fun. Like he's hitting an axe and chopping it out of like the wood stump and then using a knife to cut and then like a little carver and then sanding it. It was actually a nice, really chill day. It was really fun.
Is this something you actually have to buy or do you just like chop a trunk down and then that's what you just carve out? Like, is this really a product that needs to be purchased? I'm pretty sure they grow everywhere, you know?
No, it was a course. So you go there, you go to a warehouse and they teach you. It's called Nordic Edge, shout out, because they do like knife making and stuff like all the antique type stuff. And they just show you actually like how to do it from scratch. It was a cool skill because now like I can carve a bowl, like a wood bowl if I want. Like I've got the skills now. So it was actually better than I thought.
Yeah, well, when you're on Survivor next time, you know, you could carve out some bowls out of coconuts or, you know, whatever, and you could make a whole dinner set. That'd be awesome.
There's actually a TV show I watch called Alone where they put people out in the wilderness completely alone. It's basically last man standing. And some of those guys are ridiculous. Like they make canoes and stuff out of wood. But that was good fun. And then what else is going on? I'm going to Japan in a week and a half and driving around a camper van and working from a camper van for a couple of weeks, which should be fun.
Oh, nice, mate.
What about you, mate? Anything exciting with family, holidays?
Not as exciting as your stuff. I didn't carve out any bowls or carve out any spoons, just the normal grind, 9 to 5, you know me. But we do have an excellent podcast for you today. Who do we have on, mate?
All right, so we've got a long-standing client of ours, Anna Pham. She's a doctor, she's a GP and runs a medical clinic, but she's bought 2 properties through us. But we brought her on because she's actually got a good story about like her previous life and coming to residential and why she chose commercial, why she chose us to as a service. But the interesting thing, if you actually listen to the podcast, is we go into detail about what actually properties we bought for her, including like exactly where they are, why we bought them, what we like about them. So some good value there for the listeners.
And I like how she talks about being a little squirrel. You'll have to listen to the podcast to understand what that actually means, but she's squirreling away things. And I also like how she actually talks about some of the bad properties that she's purchased through her journey, particularly off the plan stuff and why that didn't work out. So it's a really open conversation, really diving into her portfolio because she's a very accomplished investor. She has what? It was at least 7 residential she had prior to buying a couple of commercials. I think, what, 12, 11 properties or something?
That's right. And one of the core points which I'll touch on she mentioned was she bought 1 commercial 10 years ago. And that had better cash flow than her 7 residentials combined. Yeah. And that was a lot more. So that's quite a big statement I think you need to focus on.
Yeah, that's it. All right, mate. Shall we bring her into the studio?
Let's do it.
All right, let's bring her in. Welcome to the show, Anna Pham. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, Andrew. Thank you for having me today.
You are very welcome. You're one of our top clients. So we had to get you on to, you know, let us know how you're going with your properties.
Andrew, all our clients are top clients, all right?
You're exactly right.
I'm allowed to be a favorite.
Right.
Exactly be a favorite. Yeah.
Everyone gets top level service. There's no favorites. However, Anna has a special place in my heart.
Oh, thanks, Steve.
Awesome. So can you just like introduce yourself and like share a little bit about your background before we get started?
Sure. So I'm a GP and I work in regional New South Wales and I've been in this little town for almost 20 years now. When I'm not doctoring, I'm a mother to 2 teenage kids, and they're actually very good teenage kids. I am also a co-founder of the Life Cycle Projects. Alongside Dr. B, we actually try to improve the financial literacy of doctors, i.e. we talk about everything but medicine with our colleagues. So that's me in a nutshell.
And obviously a very successful investor, hence why we're getting you on the show.
Let's see about that, Steve. Let's have the conversation and see what comes out and let the listeners decide.
You said something that really stuck with me is when you actually had to put pen to paper and write out your actual portfolio and look at equity and wealth and things like that, you were actually quite shocked with what you had. You didn't quite realize.
Yeah. So I am not very savvy in a lot of ways. And in terms of money, I'm not a person to record down every penny that I make, nor do I record where I spend the money. Putting my doctor's hat on, I would diagnose myself as having financial anxiety. And given my refugee background, I would say that I've lived up to this point with a survival mindset, which meant that there's a subconscious and conscious part of me that would fear me running out of money at any time, which meant that I worked and I worked hard and I felt a sense of responsibility to take care of not just myself and my two children, but because I am sole owner of my practices, when COVID hit, that sense of responsibility was heightened. And I'd say that was the first time I really put pen to paper to see whether there was enough funds to take care of all the important people that were, I felt like, relying on me during this time of uncertainty. And believe it or not, that was one of the first time that I put pen to paper to see what I actually had, to see whether I had enough to pay for my mortgages at that stage, and to see whether I had enough money to even keep my staff employed if, you know, these are the early days in March, April 2020, and businesses were closing, and even the health industry for the first time experienced this first shock to the system where hospitals and surgery were being closed down, and we weren't quite sure what was going to happen to general practice either. We just knew that we couldn't see patients face to face. So in this environment of uncertainty, I looked at my numbers. So that was the first time I looked at my numbers and realized that I'd been a squirrel putting money aside. And yes, I did have enough. I felt like I had enough to take us through the storm in the short term. But then second time round, which is very recently, and that's what I shared with you, Steve, where 6 months ago when I had two construction projects in the pipeline, that financial anxiety came back. And that's when I put pen to paper again and once again realized that I was a very good little squirrel and I actually will be okay despite the current climate, economic climate of high interest rates and construction woes and all of those things.
Yeah. Do you find any like common themes amongst doctors and kind of financial literacy or how they save or how they invest? Because they don't earn that much money during their training and their training is a long period and then internships and registrations and they don't quite crack a large salary until later down the track. So is that part of it where because they're so used to squirreling away at the start, when they do come into money, they've got good financial literacy? Or how have you found that with the education programs?
Absolutely not, Steve. Okay. So you're spot on there. The financial journey is a very slow and modest one for us. And you were smart not to choose medicine, despite getting the TER for it. But you know, you've got a higher TER than me, Steve. I didn't want to share that at the doctor's conference. But one of us chose to do medicine and one of us didn't. It's a very slow journey. It's a real journey in delayed gratification at so many levels and financial being one of them. So we're in the system for like 10 to 20 years at a very low base rate of income. 70, 80, 120,000 is kind of like the average figure. That's despite rigorous training and responsibilities and lots of exams and personal sacrifices to make. So do I think that that's the reason why I squirreled? Maybe, or maybe just the upbringing. There was never much. Therefore, I was always making sure I had enough for tomorrow. But in terms of financial literacy amongst the doctors, there isn't any, Steve.
Okay.
There isn't any. It's zero. It's one of the things that us doctors have in common is the fact that none of us finished medical school with any training in anything financial, from the basics of how do you do a spreadsheet, how do you do a BAS, what does it mean to open your own practice, how do you start planning for your first home when you can afford it. None of these things are taught to us. If anything, it's taboo to be talking about money. Mm. It's almost a sin to talk about money among the medical culture because unspoken that it's a calling to serve and money doesn't come into the equation. And if I could impart onto the listeners about, if I could encourage them to see the human behind the doctor. There's a human behind the title, that the doctor is really not a fanciful thing behind the scenes. We have the same vulnerabilities as everyone else without the doctor title, and we probably have lower income than you. We just have got the title, we've got higher responsibility. And in terms of financial literacy, we have zero. And perhaps that's what bonds us in our life cycle investing for doctors projects. Just the acceptance that we all came out of med school, we all came out of our subspecialty training, all with zero education on finance and everything that's non-medical.
Learning about how commercial property really works has never been easier, with so many great resources around, like this podcast and Steve's book. And he's giving it away for free if you use discount code podcast on his website. So go to www.policyproperty.com, use discount code podcast to get the book free. All you have to pay for is shipping. What a great deal.
I actually found out my best mate over, who's a surgeon, on the weekend, and he's just finished his specialties, a general surgeon, does livers and stuff like that. And he's like, I don't know what to do with private. Like, he's 37 years old, and he's like, do I hire a secretary, an office manager? Do I get an office? Do I try to talk to GPs to get referral? And I'm just like, how do you not know this? You're 37 years old. Then he started asking me advice about how to get sales, and I'm like, I'm not a doctor.
Yes, and that is a common theme amongst all of us, Steve, so common. What the lay community take for granted as being common knowledge is not common knowledge. 100% of our time is just concentrating on being rigorous with our medical training and none on anything else. And there's nowhere for us to go and learn it within the medical profession itself.
And that's really the problem with schools these days as well, is that there's no financial education. So people don't understand how to get a mortgage. They don't understand your super and things like that. And it's very, very common for, even if you do a business degree or, you know, something like that, they don't actually take one class to teach you how to advertise the business, how to get leads, you know, how to create an offer. All these things that are very vital to having a business that are just assumed that you would know that. But it's a whole different craft, like advertising, marketing, creating offers, getting in leads, making sure that you have a good brand. Like, it's a huge part of it. I think we're definitely lacking. And that's worldwide as well, I think.
Yeah. You're spot on, Andrew.
100%. Yeah.
So taking a step back, so we'll go back to the start. Why did you choose real estate for the first investment? Or was it for the first investment? And what other types of investments did you use?
It was my first investment. If you don't count savings as an investment, that's about the only two that I knew. I knew to save and I knew about property. Mm-hmm. And with property, I only knew about residential. I didn't know that any other classes existed. I knew about the family home and I knew about apartments because that's all I'd seen. I also knew the term retirement, and I knew that the wealthy people had property in order to retire. And putting that together, I ventured into the world of residential property investing.
Have you ever gone down any other path? I know you said you kind of just, like, real estate was the only thing, but you must have known about shares. Did you ever, like, have that moment where you tried to invest in shares and it didn't work out?
Not at all. Didn't know anything about the stock market. Didn't know it. Didn't have an appetite for it. Didn't trust it. I still remember talking across the fence to the next door neighbor who had lost the majority of his retirement during the GFC. And so that kind of compounded for me the fact that that wasn't something that I needed to go near. I just didn't look into it. Now I have got investments in stock, but certainly it's a recent thing over the last 2 to 3 years only. It wasn't in my radar way back when I started residential investing, Andrew.
So you basically started residential because you didn't know that well of any other investment vehicle and you thought it was probably the safest. Is that correct?
That's right, Steve. Absolutely. Okay.
Are you comfortable maybe going over a bit of your journey through, like, what you bought and kind of how you progressed and things like that?
Yeah, sure, Steve.
So do you want to start with the residential properties that you purchased and then we can move on to the commercial stuff?
Yeah, sure, Andrew. So my very first property was the marital home. That was in Sydney. So I'm from Sydney. So that was in the western suburbs of Sydney. And then I'd say a year after that, we purchased our second property out in the Kellyville way, because that was the booming area at the time. Subsequently, in the early days when I was still married, we were acquiring one property per year.
Wow.
And then when change in life circumstances occurred, that number five came down to two for me. And that's when I started again. My solo journey in property investing, I would say, commenced around 10 to 12 years ago with the two. From the two, I went into a little hiatus for 4 years where I just didn't have the headspace to be looking at properties and analyzing them. But after the 4 years, I then had FOMO and played catch up. So in the fourth or fifth year, I bought four in 1 year,
oh, wow,
two the next year. And yes, they are scattered around New South Wales, Queensland, and WA. So that brings us to seven residential properties, including my family home. So that's six investment residential properties.
Did you have any goals with the residential, or was just similar to me, like you're just accumulating because you can? You're like, oh, I've got enough money to get another one. Let's buy another one. Or was there a specific kind of goal with the residential portfolio?
A little bit of what you said and a little bit of strategy. I know I can't retire on one and I've got the savings for another one, so let's look at another one. But that's where I had a little bit of strategy going into the third, fourth, fifth and sixth ones. I have a very good accountant who I adore, and he's very much into the property space as well. And he'd give me advice and mentor me and coach me along the way. So if he said, Anna, consider the coastal suburbs down in the south coast, I would take that advice on board and look at a coastal property down the south coast that I could afford within my budget, and I'd buy it. Or if he said to me, Anna, consider land banking because that's not a part of your portfolio at the moment, but I'd like you to think multi-generational. Land banking means I'd like you to buy find land with development potential, but make sure that there's a house on it that's rentable so that you're getting some income coming through to help pay the mortgage. But it's considered a property that you may develop in your lifetime, or it may be kept for development in your children's lifetime. So he taught me the concept of thinking multi-generational. So armed with those kind of tips, I would actually be a very good student and go and carry them out and source the properties according to that goal.
Yeah, I won't give away too much, but we actually had your accountant's business partner, who's also an accountant, on one of the podcast episodes. So those that want to go back, they'll be able to find out who it is.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
I think it's also worth pointing out, if you're comfortable, you used a residential buyer's agent as well. And obviously it wasn't me at the time, but there is benefits to using buyer's agents, even in the residential space.
Yes, absolutely. So when I was advised to look for a sizable piece of land for land banking, I had, back in the days, Steve, if you can call it back in the days, my budget to buy any property was $500,000. Now, I kind of knew that within even southwest Sydney, which is where I'm from, within that vicinity, I was not going to buy a sizable piece of land with a house on it with development potential for $500,000. So that was when my wonderful accountant came in and said, consider a buyer's agent. And I remember saying, what's a buyer's agent? What do they do? What are they all about? And can you make some recommendations? And he did. So he recommended a residential buyer's agent to me, and this team found me a property in Queensland. The block of land is almost an acre. From memory, it's 3,600 square metres with an older property on it. And it already had been zoned for 16 townhouses on there. That was purchased on my behalf at $390,000. As I shared with you earlier, I had a cold call a fortnight ago with an offer of $1 million on that property as is. And the new owner was also hoping to hold on and develop it later down the track.
Yeah. And I actually think kudos to your buyer's agent. He actually said a really important thing. He's like, imagine what offer you're going to get in 10 years' time on the property as well.
That's right. He did say that. So he said, Anna, hold, because it's worth much, much more. Yes.
Yeah, awesome.
So it
sounds like you've had some very, very good help along the way. Would you say that would be pretty much the story?
Absolutely, Andrew. I would not have been able to do or purchase the really good properties without the help and guidance of my accountant or the buyer's agent. Sure, I bought things on my own as well, but I couldn't have, with the time pressure that I have, there's no way that I'd be able to increase my portfolio without help of other people.
Yeah, right.
So, Anna, you bought a couple of properties as well where you didn't take advice and they didn't work out as planned, did they?
nose thieves. So my biggest learning lessons was when I didn't take advice and when I fell for the glossy brochures. So they were off the plan, apartments, interstate. Luckily, they've always been tenanted, so at least there's some income coming, but there's been zero capital growth on these properties. Yeah, I would not do that again or recommend that strategy again, but they are what I would consider my duds because the performance of those two compared to all the others, very inferior.
What was the main driver for those? Because I find especially a lot of high net worth individuals or high income earners, I should say, they do get suckered in generally to like off the plans because of the depreciation. They're doing anything they can to reduce the tax. And I even find this with doctors where we start talking commercial and positive cash flow. Their first reaction is, oh, I have to pay tax on that. And I'm like, but you're paying tax on the income you earn through your business. Like, why is that any different for you? Is that what kind of brought it? Or you just got the point where you're trying to diversify or it just looked like a good deal at the time?
It was, those things were, so I think it's the misunderstanding by me that number one, yes, it's a brand new property, so depreciation is great, therefore tax offsets are great. Number two, I thought that if I bought off the plan that I would be paying at today's market value and that by the time it'd be completed, that there'd be capital growth in it, especially when the glossy brochures told me that there's all this infrastructure happening and going around the centre. So it's almost like an assured capital growth because of the growth in the region. What I didn't foresee and what apartments didn't offer was the shock of COVID and how apartment living was just not a popular thing. And number two, the capital growth had already been eaten up by the developers who had factored in that price and then sold it to me at today's price. And so I had zero capital growth in those apartments. Would you say that's the usual case, Steve?
Yeah, it's not me though. But the main driver I find of why they don't have the capital growth is you don't have scarcity. Like property comes down to supply and demand. Yeah. When you're buying sky space, it's infinite. Yeah. And that's what kind of holds it. Because if you ever get to a point where the prices were to grow, a developer is going to build another 20-story apartment tower. And similarly with things like office towers. That's why office towers won't grow the same as a warehouse or a retail shop because they don't own anything. You're paying for the functionality and the space in the sky, not actual dirt, which is where scarcity comes from.
And also you only own such a small portion of that land as well. So if you have 20 apartments in the property, you own 1/20th of that land, which is the actual land that appreciates. It's not the actual building on top with a single family house.
It's also unusable land as well, because unless you're going to get 20 other people to commit to doing something development-wise with it, which is never going to happen, you're kind of locked in a little bit. And I'm not saying you can't do well. I've got lots of clients and I've got friends who have done well from apartments. But like you said, Anna, it's the off the plans. You're normally paying too big of a premium to get into it. Same as a car. You can go buy a 100 grand car or you can get one that's a year old and pay $80,000 for the exact same car.
So what's the plan with those properties, Anna, now that you've obviously realized they're not really working for you and not part of the like capital growth plan? Is there any plan to sell those down or do something else with them to redeploy that capital?
So I've posed this question to my wonderful accountant once again. I run everything by him now. And the advice was, if you don't need to sell, then just hold. If it's not eroding into your serviceability and your cash flow, then just hold. And so I'm just holding. But it's a learning lesson not to be repeated again.
I always tell clients, never take selling lightly, like because just transferring a property to another property is about a 10% swing. Because you've paid stamp duty already, you're going to pay selling agent costs of 2 to 2.5%, going to pay stamp duty on the next one of 3.5% or so. You start getting up to 10% just to push it into. So unless, like your accountant said, unless it's eroding your cash flow and stopping you from getting to the next property, or you think you've missed out on opportunity costs, like you said, you might have a really, really big dud in a mining town and you want to cut your losses. Selling, I would never take lightly.
Yeah.
Perfect. And so how many, like, it sounds like you've got a lot of property here. Like, how many residential properties did you actually buy before you started into commercial?
Around 7. I'd actually, in that space, purchased 2 commercial on my own as well. So that brought it up to 9. And then I found your team and you purchased the rest for me.
What was the push to make the official change to commercial? Because I know you've obviously bought for your business and things like that as well. But what was this kind of turning point for, okay, I need to buy commercial now, or at least I'm going to look into buying commercial?
Yeah. So COVID was the catalyst for that, Steve. So once again, in the sitting down with a piece of paper and an Excel sheet, I realized that while I had good capital growth in my resi properties, I realized that I was a holder. I wasn't selling. And because I wasn't selling, I wasn't realizing the capital growth. And if I wasn't realizing capital growth, then I needed a form of income to offset mine, especially if I'm thinking about retirement or planning retirement. And out of the two commercial properties that I purchased myself, one, as I said, is currently under construction, so let's not count that. But the other one I've had for 10 years now, and that gave me, like, that was where the majority of my property income was coming from that one commercial property. And so that's when I flipped the strategy and thought, I'm a holder, capital growth will come, the income is going to come with commercial property, or so says my portfolio. So now I'm going to really learn a lot more about commercial property, understand it more, and concentrate on that. And that's where my shift occurred.
Quite a powerful statement. Most of my cash flow was coming from one property out of my seven portfolio property. Like, yeah. That's, for me, is quite a big statement, which we overlooked slightly, but that's quite important to probably the shift in the mindset as well.
That must have been a massive eye-opener when you realize that. Were you like, what am I doing here? Like, all my money is coming from here. Why do I have all this other stuff that's really just like hemorrhaging money? It's capital growth play. Like, it must have been a bit of a break point for you.
Well, yeah, so it was a breakthrough. So by then I had had nine and two commercial, but one was producing income. And that one that was producing income, so I'm positively geared. So because I pay my P&I into my resi, I had paid down the debts and therefore they're positively geared. But in comparison to this one commercial property that was generating income, all the resi seemed like petty cash. It was as clear as day. You didn't need to be a math genius to realize where the income was coming from when it comes to property investing.
People don't realize this. Like, a lot of clients and like listeners, they think I'm trying to, like, I don't know, make up something like sugarcoat commercial property. And like, they think I'm talking, it's too good to be true. But it's like, there's nothing complicated about it. It's what rent you get minus the outgoings. There's no outgoings besides your mortgage. So it's very simple calculation, but for some reason people think you're trying to lie to them about it.
No, it's as simple as that, Steve. It's as simple as that at the end of the day. I think that the beginning stages is difficult, like the acquisition and the due diligence is difficult for someone like myself. But once you're in it and it's a good purchase, the management is so simple. The money flow is so simple. I'm really enjoying seeing the money coming to the bank account for those properties on a monthly basis. It's very rewarding.
So did you work out how many residential properties you would need and to have them paid off to replace that commercial property income?
Yep. I would need, 10 to 20 resi to make up for that one commercial.
Yeah. It's just so many that you need. And you have to have them all paid down. It's almost like an impossible feat to be able to get that good income. But I probably think it's a good time to also highlight that, being that you are a doctor, like, some people might be going, how does she keep on borrowing more and more, like buying more and more property? Being a doctor, you have very, very good lending criteria from the bank. Do you want to just explain what the benefits of being a doctor is from, you know, lending institutions?
Well, it's funny, Andrew. I know exactly what you're trying to say. You're going to ask me whether I used 95% LVR with no LMI as a doctor.
Yep.
I never utilized those.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I never utilized them. No, I'm a squirrel. I don't like debt. And so they'd go in and offer 95 LVR, no LMI, and I'll say, no, thank you. I'd like to buy that at 80%. Oh, actually, make it 70% and make it P&I. What's the rate for P&I versus interest only? Anna, pay this off. Come on.
Andrew, Anna has a ridiculously low LVR, to the point when we had our first sales call with her, I was just like, you know, you could do way more than this. She's like, no, we'll get this one done cash.
That's awesome.
So, but yes, I am forever being told that I'm underutilizing my portfolio and the potential funds that could be released to buy more, to create more. That can be the next phase.
Yeah, but it doesn't. We've had this chat personally as well, Anna. Like, I'm somewhat similar. I've got quite a low LVR, and I don't yearn to have a large LVR because I've got enough. So, like, having a pay down strategies, and there'll always be another property kind of pop up, but I don't have to have 30 properties. I don't want it. That's a headache to me. No. Other people like Andrew, he's going to have hopefully 10, 20 self-storage facilities because that's what he loves and that's his goal. So you just kind of got to match up what you're actually trying to achieve. But how did you find when you were buying commercial? Because like you said, it's the numbers aren't difficult. Where it really comes down to is the due diligence, making sure you don't stuff up that. So how did you get educated? I think that's how you came across us, wasn't it? Either the book or the podcast that we kind of do.
Yes. So I listened to your podcast. I listened to a lot of other podcasts as well. Mm-hmm. And if you or other podcasters had a book on offer, I'd download it or purchase it or pay for freight and delivery. And I listened to those fundamental 10 podcasts that you created in the early days, Steve. Mm-hmm. I listened to it again and again and again.
You're the 20 listens that we have.
Because my mind wanders a bit as I'm listening and driving, and so I'd miss things. And I'm too time-poor to pick up a book and read it all in the one go. So I had to always cement the knowledge by listening to it again and again. And I'd find that I'd miss one thing or another, or I'm picking up something or another. And I remember sharing your podcast with friends and preaching what you were saying even before I had made contact with you to say, did you know anything about commercial property? Did you know this? Did you know that? And anyway, I was ready. I was a disciple by that stage, and I was ready to talk to buyers, agents in the commercial space and really jump deep into it.
Yeah. So just to summarize, because you still had capacity for residential. So yours, like a lot of clients will come because they run out of capacity for residential, but yours was more of a goal of passive income because you realized, like you said, your wealth was locked in equity. So unless you had a sell down strategy, that wasn't really helping. So you wanted to generate the passive income through commercial.
Precisely, Steve. So at the time that I made contact with your team, I was 45. I'm 48 now. I was 45 and I gave myself a goal of being able to retire by the age 55. Not because I wanted to stop working, but it was just a goal that I set for myself. You have to have a number, an end goal. So I said, well, Anna, if you're going to retire in 10 years, how are you going to replace your income? And I set myself an arbitrary number that was in the six digits. And the current portfolio was not going to achieve that. But I could achieve it if I had more commercial properties generating the same income as the one that I already had. And so that was when I knew that only commercial would allow me to retire if I wanted to at the age of 55. Yeah, it was as simple as that.
That's another powerful statement as well. Like over what, 8 years, you can then actually have a retirement strategy with commercial?
Yes. I literally could retire with that one commercial property if I wanted to because I live quite frugally, as you can tell. I don't need a lot to enjoy life to its fullest, to have a couple of holidays a year with my kids, to buy that latte anytime that I wanted to. I just knew that I had capability to grow a little bit more in that investing space if I wanted to. And I saw commercial as being the only way to do so. Remembering too that a big part of me worries about the fact that the sole income earner in my household. And so I always am worried about the fact that if something were to happen to me, what would happen to my children? You know, and as I reach, this is going to sound funny, boys, I'm talking to two boys, but perimenopause and hot flushes and night sweats, sexy as it is, reminds me of my own mortality and reminds me that I really need to find a way to replace my income, such that if something physically happened to me, that there was a safety net.
Yeah, don't, Andrew gets those same hot flushes when he finds a good storage facility. I love doctors are so open with medical stuff because it's such the norm for them.
Yeah, I talk it day in, day out, Steve.
So why do you engage us anyway then? So because you bought one for your business, one else outside of that. Was it just to kind of explore more options, kind of cast a wider net?
Absolutely, Steve. Absolutely, that's the reason why. I didn't need it for business anymore. I just wanted it for purely for investment purposes. And honest reason I engaged you, Steve Polisi, was because you spoke to me.
Okay.
So it's a personal thing of mine that I like talking to the owner of a company that I'm working with. I don't need much of their time. I just like talking to them. And the reason I like that is, being a business owner myself, I understand the value of culture. I understand that culture starts from the top. So if I get 5 or 10 minutes of the owner's time, I'll make a judgment call about the quality of the workplace and the quality and the culture and the values that the team is going to bring into the project. So if I get to talk to you, Steve, and I think that you're a nice, decent guy with high integrity, I'm going to make the value judgment that your entire team is going to be kind, honest, of high integrity, and will do what they say that they will do. I'm not going to always get it right, but I will still talk to the owner if I can. And you were the only owner, not in Australia, who picked up the phone and spoke to this cool stranger on the other end of the phone. I'm really appreciative of you for doing so. And I thoroughly enjoyed the fact that, and I find it really inspirational, Steve, that you can run a business and it doesn't have to be in an office and it doesn't have to be in Australia, that you can be overseas doing what you love, living the, you know, your best life, and able to talk to someone like me who, you know, is really a novice in the commercial property space or in all property space. I have so much more to learn. And you were willing to talk to me. And you've made such a big difference to my portfolio and my life. So that's the reason why I chose the Polisi team. And I've not been disappointed.
That's actually one of the ethos of our company is like, so me and Andrew talk to every client. We want to make sure everyone has the same experiences. No, there. Sometimes Andrew talks to them first, I talk to them second and vice versa, but it's you talk to the whole team, which is good, which you saw as well. And we'll go through your experience, but everyone in the team will work with you as well. It's not just cool, see you later. We all work together, which is quite nice. We don't necessarily want a team that does 100 deals a month because we don't want that. We want this relationship where we get people like you that are leaving good reviews, come on the podcast, have a good experience, tell their friends and have good outcomes.
Yeah, it's about building a long-term relationship with the clients, and we're helping them with wealth through their whole life. It's not become about money anymore. It's more about the helping. How many people can we help multiple times and build a really good business like that?
Yeah.
One of my kind of feel-good moments is I get clients from like 5 years ago when I spoke to them and they weren't in a position to buy. And then they reach out now being like, I'm going with you no matter what because you gave me the time of day when I wasn't ready.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Nice. And I like that, Steve. And ultimately, it's what life is all about. And I think ultimately we can talk about investing and the money that's generated. It's a vanity metric and it doesn't hold any true value until you can use that for good. If I can't use what I've learned from you or all those important people around me for good and share that knowledge and to make the life of other people better, and if I hold that all to myself, I'm not living a life of giving. And it's a vanity metric, doesn't mean very much once you're dead. So, yeah.
When me and Andrew started this podcast, it was like, as soon as you take away the we're trying to make money and you just kind of go into the mindset of let's try to give as much value as we can. And that's why like podcast is free, books free, all the spreadsheets on the website, resource, like there's no secrets. I find the more we give, the more we receive.
Yeah. And I find that too.
And creating those foundational episodes that Steve and I did, that nearly killed Steve and I. We would do back-to-back episodes, because it's so difficult to convey how you can invest in commercial property just audibly. So we really basically just went through Steve's book and went line by line, chapter by chapter. And we didn't just do one episode at a time. We'd be doing back-to-back episodes. So we'd be talking to each other for 4 hours sometimes by all accounts. It's been very well received. So
yeah.
Yeah.
What people didn't see is we normally take about 3-4 hours prep just to prep what we're going to talk about. Yeah. Then we talk for about 4 hours per episode and then that would get trimmed down to an hour and a half. So it took a long time, but we're trying to basically do a course that people could listen to and it gives them all the information because, and like you said, you have to listen to it multiple times to get your head around it. In hindsight, we probably crammed too much in, but 10 episodes sounds a bit nicer to listen to than listen to our 35 episode all-inclusive podcast.
It's information dense, but you got great quality content in there.
Yeah, that's it.
Thank you.
So in terms of commercial property, obviously we are saying good, nice, positive things about commercial property, but there are challenges along the way. Commercial property does have its downfalls. Did you face any challenges when you started investing in commercial real estate?
So with the ones that your team found for me, I'm probably too early in the game to experience any negative cycles or negative experiences yet. With the two that I purchased myself, the development side was what I found really difficult. So all of my woes were in development and construction. So just a quick share, my learning lessons would be council makes it really hard when you're the first one to develop in a particular area. So in this part of Southwest Sydney, they had just rezoned this whole block from residential into mixed use. And so I was one of the first purchasers to acquire the properties that were on the market and then put in a DA, or put in an application to convert it into a health facility. And although it met the requirements, council in their wisdom had something else completely different in their grand plans, which was that they wanted the whole block to be demolished and converted into a three-story building. And it didn't matter that not every single property was on the market for sale. Therefore, not one developer could in, even if their pockets were deep enough, to create the vision that council wanted. That didn't matter to them. The fact that that was their vision, and one little Asian woman came in and said, I've got this property and this is what I'd like to do, and it's permissible under the use of the zoning. Why can't I do it? Became a huge negotiation with council. Oh, wow. Yeah, so I've learned it's hard to be the first. So it's hard to be a pioneer, so to speak. So that was quite difficult. Once the tenant was in, though, it's a health tenant. They pay on time. They don't cause any issues. And like I said, I love that property and I love that investment, yeah, for its entire package. Maybe we can talk about the ones that the policing team have bought for me and what you envision for those properties as time goes on.
Yeah, okay, if you're comfortable. Do you want me to give a quick run through for the listeners of just what we bought you and why we bought them and things like that?
Yeah, sure, Steve.
Okay, all right. So Anna was buying two properties through us because we're trying to generate a passive income for retirement. Like, that's effectively what we're buying. So we obviously want a bigger yield as possible with as low risk as possible. So we actually broke it up into diversifying into like a warehouse and a retail. So for me, the first one we got was Willawong, I believe, which is in the southeast corridor of Brisbane. It's a warehouse with a tenant, decent lease. It's a successful business that's been there, and they're actually passing it on to one of their employees. But why I really like this one is, first thing, vacancy rates are ridiculously low. So we got this property for 1.6 mil. I think it was about a 5.7% net yield, but it's got two different titles. So it's two different properties. So if one of the tenant basically leaves, we can separate out to two tenants at a higher square meter rate and actually get a better cash return or diversify over the two tenancies. So I think we got that one just before Christmas, didn't we? And it was basically a quick sale that we kind of nabbed in, and that's why we got it at a good price. So that's the low risk kind of bulletproof one that I know you're never going to have an issue with. If you lose your tenant, you'll get a tenant in a month or two, on with our life kind of thing. The next one's a bit of a high yield. I think it's like 6.9% net yield. So we got that in North Perth, so in Warwick. It's a retail. It's an Italian restaurant. It's in a big shopping center. It's actually, there's a McDonald's there and a Coles there. But it's actually the property that's next to a cinema. So that's got a positive and a negative. We told you this at the time, and we've had chats about this in the past. The first thing we did as due diligence was actually check how successful that cinema would be. Because it's at the front of the cinema, you're basically banking on the foot traffic from that going there. And part of the due diligence, we actually found that the cinema, which was an independent cinema, was getting sold to Hoyts. So we found that's part of due diligence. We let you know. That's actually a good thing. So this sort of flows on. So this is the slightly high risk one, because if you ever lose the tenant, it's a slightly longer vacancy period. You're probably looking at 6 to 12 months, but you'll get them for longer. But with Hoyts moving in, that's minimized. But the first issue, like you said, times where you find the issues is now that Hoyts is coming in, I believe the owner of the Italian restaurant is actually looking to sell it because he's trying to make a premium. So you're going to have a slight headache of obviously subleasing or getting a new tenant, potential small incentives if they want to refresh the shop and things like that. But that was the general strategy, was try to buy the low risk one and get a really high yielding, slightly higher risk one, which kind of cancels it out. So that way you're always in a strong position.
We have spoken about this property in a previous podcast as well. I didn't know that was your property, so it's cool to put a face to the property. But what I actually liked about that deal was that the rate per square meter that was being charged before Hoyts moved in would be significantly lower. Now Hoyts are there, you would have to make a case that the foot traffic has considerably increased. So your rate per square meter on that property for a new tenant is going to be much higher. Therefore, just for the surrounding like other tenancies that have drawn more traffic, you've increased the value of that property by increasing the rate per square meter purely because there's a great tenant next to you that's pulling in all the people there.
Yeah. What I like, Andrew, is because it's a retail, it's on the outside of the shopping center. So you've still like, I generally don't buy inside shopping centers because the yields aren't sharp enough. But like, I'm just looking on the map now. Like, we've got McDonald's right next door. There's a Kmart, there's a Coles, There's three or four gyms. There's a hairdresser, jewelry, ANZ. There's a petrol station across the road. There's a Red Rooster in the complex. There's a Telstra. Like, it's got all the fundamental ones. So it's not one where I'm concerned the shopping center is going to die. So, like, it's not like a little suburban one with three or four shops where if one of the IGA leaves, you're going to have an issue. So that's what I like about this one. We're in the big complex. We've got exposure on the road. It's a versatile premise. It could be anything, but I imagine it's always going to be some type of like restaurant, maybe a fast food. Hopefully the tenant does leave. They sell it to like a Guzman Gomez or a fast food type retail, and then you get a long lease that way. But I'm not concerned that you're ever going to be out of a tenant for longer than, say, 6 to 12 months.
It actually looks like it could work as like a Pizza Hut or a Domino's or something, to tell you the truth. That'd be fitting nicely there.
Yeah, it ticks all the fundamental boxes. And the yield's ridiculous. We're getting like a 6.8% net yield with a long lease on. I think at the time I had about a five-year lease, and we're looking to get a new tenant. Hopefully the new tenant that takes over or buys the business, if they do sell it, wants to extend and sign an even longer lease. But like I said, the main thing is it always has a tenant, and it actually gives you that passive income so you can retire in, what was it, 7 years?
Yeah, 7 years, yes. We're getting older now.
And Steve, do you just want to clarify what years we purchased these for, Anna?
They've all been the last 2 years, haven't they, Anna?
So yeah, I think just before Christmas 2022. And the next one was maybe January 2023. It was in very close succession. And the reason for that was you had actually offered those properties to another buyer, but those buyers couldn't come up with the finance within the time frame, the 6 weeks, because the banks were very slow like they are now. The finance clause had lapsed. And so they were about to go to market, put those properties on the market. And that's when Liam Carmody reached out to me and said, these have become available. Are you interested? And I said, yes.
That's one of the advantages, I suppose, of buyer's agent. The agents have a good relationship with us. So when they know, like, if, say, finance won't get extended and they know they're going to go to market, we can be like, oh, look, we've actually got a cash buyer. Can we get into this? And we've already done a lot of the due diligence on it as well. So we knew it was actually a good deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, the timing doesn't matter. I always tell people you buy when you're financially ready and when the deal makes sense to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
But yeah, both good deals. And yeah, very happy. I'm looking forward to the next one. We're actually potentially working with you on finding a medical practice as well, which is interesting.
Yeah. So I'm renting where I am at the moment. So I'm hoping to buy one to settle into. Fingers crossed.
So how has your investing in commercial property evolved over time? Like, has it evolved over time, and what has it evolved to?
It's evolved in that I wouldn't try and do it by myself again. I think I feel like I've been spoilt in the process. I can see the value of not needing to reinvent the wheel. Let the professionals do what they do really well. Let them do that. So I'd be once again going to you, or I'd be seeking a buyer's agent to help me source the property.
No, you're right. Just use us. No need to talk to anyone else. Andrew, cut that in the second half of the sentence out, right?
For the due diligence, I could not do the level of due diligence that you guys did on the property. And in both cases, there's been value for money. There's definitely value for money. I've made what you guys have achieved for me, and even with the resi buyer's agent, what he was able to achieve for me has been more than offset the fees. So, for example, the one that you bought for me in Queensland, Wollongong, Queensland, 1 month after purchase, it was time for rental appraisal, and that went up by CPI plus a certain percentage. So I made the gain there straight away in terms of yield and capital growth based on that. So yeah, my learning lesson would be I'm going to stick to what I do well, which is being a doctor and being a mum, and I'm going to let the property professionals like you guys do what you do well, and I consider you part of the team now, part of my property team, and I wouldn't even try to do it on my own anymore. Time is too precious, and I'd rather you did it, because I'd get a better quality outcome by asking you for help than trying to do it myself. I wouldn't be saving anything by trying to do it by myself.
Are you saying your patients shouldn't be Googling their symptoms?
They're forever coming here and saying, I'm so sorry, I did look it up. I know it's a bad thing. I do look it up, but I'm here to chat to you about it.
Never Google a baby symptom, ever. They're always going to die. You Google it, they're going to die within 5 hours.
Oh, no, they've got meningitis. That rash is a meningitic rash, and they're going to die. Yeah.
Stay up to date with all the hints, tips and tricks in commercial property by following Polisi Property on Facebook. Go to Polisi Property hit that follow button and never miss a beat with Polisi Property. So how did you end up structuring these deals like and financing them? Did you use a trust? Did you use your personal name? How did you go with that process?
I once again have a very good accountant who helps with all of that. So I have it in all different structures, Andrew. I've got things under my personal name. I've got things in trust. I've got things under a company structure as well. It's all based on our users for that property and where I was getting the funding from.
That's the key point I wanted to say. You have a very good accountant. Like me and Andrew, we get asked regularly, like, oh, what should I be buying this under? And I'm like, talk to your good accountant. Like that whole thing comes down to tax minimization and asset protection. And then if you marry that up with your broker to make sure your lending's not restricted, you shouldn't have to understand it. I find quite a lot of doctors want to understand every intricacy about how the trusts work or the company's set up. You don't have to. Like every time I make a purchase, I call my accountant saying, I'm buying this. This is a yield. This is the purpose of the property, how long I'm going to hold it for. And they tell me what to buy it under because that's their expertise.
Yeah. We should mention his name. I've mentioned him so much and given him so much credit for everything that he's achieved for me. Just means I have to share him.
Shout out to Munzirul
Khan. Partners, the best in the business.
Fun story. He was actually my first accountant. So when I was first up and coming, but because I was so like active investor, I'd call him like every second day and he'd take a day or two to get back to me. And because I'm like, I've got to get a property. And then I met his business partner, Jeremy, who we had on the podcast, and he was being more reactive. So that I'm like, sorry, Munzirul, I'm talking to Jeremy now. He gets back to me really quickly. And that's part of growing as well. And that's, we'll come up against the same thing, you and I, Andrew, when as we get more interest and more clients, at some point we're going to be overloaded and you'll have to reassess.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I found out in working with you, Steve, that you work at a really fast pace. Usually people would be fast in a certain facet of the interaction. So you could have that meet and greet, you could have the follow-up email, and you could have an action list, and that could all happen very quickly. But then that action list may sit in my inbox for quite a while. And until I respond, the other party won't respond back. So then I'm allowed that breathing space or that lazy space to do nothing, because by that point, they're allowing me to work at my pace, which is going to be a very slow pace if you leave it to me, because I'll get distracted by other things. But you, Steve, I found in my experience with working with the Polisi team that it's a fast pace and it's a consistently fast pace. So from the time I spoke to you to the time that your team found me a property, that was within a week. From the time I said, yes, you know, let's press the green button, to them putting me in contact with a solicitor conveyancer, a managing agency, getting the contract through, signing the deal, my head was spinning. It was really fast. I'd never worked with a team that worked at your team's pace.
I want to make a full disclaimer. Not everyone gets a property in the first week. You had circumstances from time of year and because of cash buying as well, we could look at offers. Normally, on average, it's about 1 to 2 months for us to get a client into a property. But
we're putting a disclaimer in now, aren't you, Steve?
No, but in all seriousness, it's because we're selective. Like I mentioned before, we're not trying to do 100 deals a month. We're trying to do 10 to 20 really good deals a month. And that's kind of why the issue for us is actually finding the deals. Like that's the bottleneck. And that's why we kind of restrict how many clients we take on.
Could I share onto that quick pace and why it was able to happen and tying it to the structure and all of that as well? Well, the third piece of the equation is the finance. And we laughed about me being financially anxious and feeling more comfortable with the lower LVR. But during that time, the only reason I was able to jump and purchase those properties when your team had it on offer was because I had spent 12 months preparing for that day. So it wasn't like an overnight decision. I had spent 12 months getting my finances in order, time talking to the banks. I knew what the budget was. I knew at what point I was able to just jump and make a cash purchase. And with that in mind, when your team did come to me just before Christmas and say, this is what's on offer, can you do it? And I said, yes. And then we have the discussion about if we remove the finance clause and just kept in the pest and building inspection clause, kind of what help would that be? And I learned that that was a huge help to remove the finance clause, because even while that was happening, I had working with the broker to get a loan in place, and that didn't come into effect until 3 months later. So I would have lost that deal as well, just like the first potential purchaser, had I not planned well in advance.
We never really sell this, but one of the advantages of the buyer's agent is actually, force is the wrong word, but we force people to actually buy where they've been sitting on their hands for too long or not. And Andrew, you actually made a really good video the other week on social media where you said, what's the biggest mistake most investors make? And your response was...
not taking any action.
Not taking any action. And that's it. And we get this almost every day. Someone calls up and they're like, oh, I've been thinking about this for a year or two. And you're like, well, you've missed out on hundreds of thousands of dollars. You should have just bought something bulletproof back then. So I suppose that's an advantage of the buyer's agent, actually just forcing something, because it's, well, you're a busy professional. So I imagine some nights you don't have time to sit on Real Commercial and have a look. But when someone's actively sending you deals, calling you up, being like, hey, this is a good deal, should you jump on it? At least it forces your hand a little bit.
Yeah, it does. It's a real encouragement. Yeah.
So what advice would you give someone that was considering commercial real estate investing for their retirement?
I would say it's a great vehicle for retirement because of the great income. However, it does come with its risks. So please educate yourself. Educate yourself by listening to podcasts like your Foundational 10 podcast and read books. And then for my peers out there, so if I'm talking to doctor peers or any professionals out there, I'd say don't let the detail overwhelm you. Don't let analysis paralysis lead you to inaction. Sometimes it's good to just be armed with the information so that you can keep your team accountable. So if I kind of understand how the mechanics of commercial property works and I engage a buyer's agent and they are talking in a language that I understand and the numbers and everything marries up, then I know I'm onto a good thing. I would highly recommend it, especially for people who are thinking about retirement halfway through their life like I did, where there's a little bit less time in the horizon to wait for capital growth to generate that income. I love it. I psychologically find it really hard to go back to investing in residential. I really do. However, I would do it if it's a special property, like a clifftop or beachfront or something special like that.
Yeah.
But it's really, I'm finding it really difficult to be convinced to buy in suburbia and wait for that capital growth. Yeah.
I think you made a good point. I don't think you realized you made it, was getting educated actually makes our job easier. Surprisingly, people think it's the other way around where we're going to pull the wool over someone's eyes. But when someone actually understands like commercial, the deal happens because they understand the DD report. They understand the process. They ask the right questions. More importantly, it means we can't pull the wool over their eyes. So we actually get into a deal faster the more you understand.
Yeah.
And so what are the future plans with commercial property? Are we buying more? What's the goals?
So the goal is to get the current two constructions underway and completed and start generating some income from them. I have one residential that's putting in for DA approval for a duplex. So I actually would like to construct that next because I think that I'll get quite a good yield out of that given its location. And then after that, I think I'll be sitting down and looking to see what's left and going from there. But like I said, it'd be difficult to convince me to go back to residential unless it's a unique property.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you so much, Anna. And thank you so much for your transparency. Not a lot of people are willing to obviously be as open and honest about their portfolio. So really, really appreciate you coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me, Steve. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you very much for your time.
No worries. Thank you so much. This has been Anna Pham, Steve Polisi and Andrew Bean on the Commercial Property Investing Explained series. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Commercial Property Investing Explained series. This show has been produced by the Commercial Property Show Network.